Okay.
Many years of trust has been built up with Alistair that when he says something like that, he's then about to make a very interesting point off the back of it. But at the moment, he's taken me to the water and hasn't let me drink.
Well, we're trying to figure this out.
We were. I know. I'm not expecting you to know. It's quite refreshing to know that you don't know everything.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life, theology, the church, and the culture. My name is Derek Rishmawi. I'm joined by Alistair Roberts and our frequently appearing guest and longstanding member, Andrew Wilson, has decided to join us today. Sadly, Matthew won't be with us. But we decided to take up an interesting, weird, oddball question this morning, or yeah, it's morning for me, and basically America is the center of the world, and so I'm just going to assume it's morning for everyone else across the Atlantic as well. But this morning we wanted to talk about just a weird oddball passage in Matthew. We were trying to think about what to talk about today, and we were looking for weird passages, and this one struck us, and so I'm going to read it. And then we're just going to go ahead and see what to make of it. So this happens in Matthew chapter 27, right at the death of Jesus, at the sixth hour when he cries out, "My God, my God." But in verse 51, reads like this: "And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. And when the centurion and those who were with him keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" So, what we wanted to look at today is what the heck is going on with the tombs being opened. And the bodies of the saints, which had fallen asleep, are now raised and walking around the city like it's all Hallows Eve or something like that. And so, in advance of the general resurrection. So that's what we want to talk about today. Kind of just how to think about it theologically, textually. How would you preach something like this if you're at one of those churches that actually makes sure you go through every verse and not just, you know, snippets of Matthew in a 10-week series kind of thing? That's the useful bit of those kinds of series, is that you just kind of get to little leapfrog over these things. But yeah, we want to look at what is going on with this, because it's in God's Word, it's part of the Gospels, is clustered right next to this very important confession of Jesus by the centurion and the temple, you know, garment being torn in two, the curtain of the temple. And so what the heck do we do with that? So I'm a systematician, so I'm just going to pitch it over to Andrew or Alistair. Andrew, how about, let me ask you, not necessarily what you think it means, but like what extra stands out to you about this passage? What are the oddities, or what are the things that you, yeah, some things that struck you, you think we need to?
It's all weird. It's all weird. It's just weird. We'll try and make some sense of it, I'm sure. But it's weird in several ways, isn't it? It seems to be okay. So a few things that occur to me as I'm reading it. It's weird. This would be true of a number of things in the Gospels, but it's weird that only Matthew mentions it. It seems to me to be more surprising an omission in the other Gospels, given that it's something that people are familiar with, you know, however you read it, however, you know, even if you go down the whole, this is a sort of an early exegetical tradition rather than something they actually thought had happened, even then it would be very strange to omit it, let alone if they're just reporting historical events. Why isn't it anywhere else? Why is the timing Good Friday rather than Easter Sunday? I mean, that's an obvious one, isn't it? You read through and you think, resurrection, surely that's associated with Easter Sunday rather than specifically with Good Friday. So I think that's strange. How long did, I mean, obviously it's weird that we don't hear anything more about these individuals. How long were they alive for? You know, they were raised, they come out, they appear to many, and then what? What happens then? Do they just go and die again? How long are they out and about? It's just that's peculiar. How is it that the rest of the world don't react with much more? Why is that never mentioned in the context of the narrative of Acts when preaching in Jerusalem? You know, this is staringly obvious that he was risen from the dead, not just because the tomb was empty, but because you guys saw all these dead people around. And I think, and it's also associated, obviously, in an interesting way with there seem to be three things that are split or cut in half in this tiny little section you just read, right? So the temple curtain is split, and the rocks and the earth itself are split at the end of verse 51. And then the tombs, if you like, are opened or split, and people come out of those. And I'm assuming that there is a significance there in terms of its the way the story's told, drawing together, you know, the breaking of these symbols of the old age, the idea of the separation between God and man being broken at the same time as the earth and the grave being split, all being aligned with each other. I can get that. But I do nevertheless find it interesting, if not very bizarre, that these things all happened in the way that they did on that day, and that no one else tells us about it or tells us any more than this about it. So it is a very strange passage. And I think I could see some application for, you know, in preaching and pastoral life to some of the connections between, as I just mentioned, between the things that are opened, but the weirdnesses are still there and they still bother me somewhat. So that's, it's a fascinating text from that perspective.
And like this also comes significantly right after the darkness, right? The sky becoming the dark, and right the contrast of the death crying out to God, darkness, and then after it the definitive moment of his death, all these signs happening, that also struck me, Alistair. Let's get some more. I mean, you are our best weirdo Bible God.
Well, this is a passage that perplexes me in many ways, but we do have, as Andrew mentioned, it is out of sequence within the narrative. So a number of the events that of the opening of the graves and the appearing in the city, the holy city, that's interesting, that occurs after the resurrection. So you have a reference to the resurrection and the earthquake in verse 2 of chapter 28. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came back and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. So there is an earthquake at that point, but that earthquake also opens the graves. And the question is, why is it there's many questions, but one of the questions is, why do we have the earthquake recorded at this point rather than later on? And that triad of different events, the veil of the temple being torn in two, the earthquake, and then the graves being opened. What is it about those events that are connected together in that significant way that there should be the recording of them in that one spot?
Alistair, are you saying then that you think that it's not just that after Jesus's resurrection they went into the city? You're saying you think that actually even the raising from the dead and the opening of the tombs took place, as in verse 52, takes place on Easter Sunday and not on Good Friday, and it's been displaced in the narrative, and therefore that when the centurion and those who were with him keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they said, surely this was the Son of God. You think that's referring to Easter Sunday, not Good Friday? Is that what you're saying?
Well, verse 53, and coming out of the graves after his resurrection. And when does the earthquake happen? In
verse exactly
2
of
chapter
saying,
28, the earthquake happens at the point of the resurrection.
This is what Calvin says in his commentary. I was looking up right now, and he says, yet it's doubtful that if this opening of the graves took place before his resurrection, for in my opinion, the resurrection of the saints, which is mentioned immediately after, was subsequent to the resurrection of Christ. And so he keeps on, he goes back and forth drawing attention also theologically to basically the necessity.
So that means
Christ
that the centurion's announcement, this was the Son of God, is referring not to anything the centurion says on the Friday at all. But so it's not parallel in that sense with Mark 15, surely, you know, and Luke 23. This is a
different confession.
A reference to something that the centurion said subsequently.
It seems like it.
And it's worth bearing in mind that the witnesses of these events, among the particular witnesses of what happens with the earthquake and the opening of the tombs, are the guards at in Matthew 28 verse 4. And so maybe it connects the character of the centurion with the guards that you see upon Jesus' tomb later on. And so in Mark, the testimony of the centurion occurs at the point of the cross. And I think it does occur there, but there's a connection, a conflation of two sets of events. That's which itself is significant.
But then it's kind of sandwiched. You've got the conclusion there in that little section, pericope, and then there were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And this is right before the burial account. I'm just curious why.
And you can imagine reading this account. You read this account, and then you have, and coming out of the graves. Spoiler alert! After his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. I mean, this is the big punchline: the resurrection. And here Matthew preempts it, which itself is an interesting thing.
If I understand you right, Alistair, you're saying we have there's a textual displacement, but not a historical displacement here. I think that's what you're saying. No. So as in, this is the text has put it here, but historically it doesn't happen until Easter Sunday. And I'm saying that to me, if that is what you're saying, I'm saying that to me makes verse 54 very strange.
Verse 54 relates to the veil in the Mark, it's the veil of the temple that leads, if I recall, that leads to the centurion's confession.
Right, but it also says they saw the earthquake.
Includes all of those things, yes.
So it sounds from the text, doesn't it, like the tearing of the temple curtain and the shaking of the earth both take place at the time of the death of Christ, and then therefore that the centurion seeing that and going, this guy was the Son of God. That's only how the text reads, and I agree that the coming out of the tombs bit could be left till Easter Sunday, but the other bits surely couldn't. This is what I'm thinking as I'm looking at it and frantically searching through commentaries as we're talking, trying to work out how they
should handle this. That's curious. That's a really curious. I mean, at the same time, and this is very classic harmonizing. There's part of me that just thinks, okay, well, if you had one centurion who knew about the one thing, and then it makes sense for whatever centurion or whatever guards by the tomb to say something like that after it splits open and somebody walks out. But it's basically the same confession, and so I do wonder about Matthew and Mark, like how much this is the conflation actually. Yeah, I can't double that confession in a way that I might want to double two different stories or the angels or something like that. So, Alistair, fix it. Tell me.
And if I recall, no, I'm just going to make things more complicated. If I recall, there is only one other occasion within the New Testament outside of Revelation that there is a reference to the holy city, and that's in the devil taking Christ into the holy city, to the pinnacle of the temple, in Matthew chapter 4. So the reference to the holy city, it's an unusual way of putting it. It's not the common terminology that we'd maybe expect. They went into Jerusalem, we'd maybe expect to read. The fact it's the holy city is interesting.
Right. I'm anticipating cash value of that point.
What's going on? Oh man. Okay.
Over many years of trust has been built up with Alistair that when he says something like that, he's then about to make a very interesting point off the back of it. But at the moment, he's taken me to the water and hasn't let me drink.
What? Well, we're trying to figure this out. Part of the point of this episode is that we're actually thinking about this thing out loud.
Sure. I wondered if you were saying
5 minutes before we started.
We were. I know. I'm not expecting you to know. It's quite refreshing to know that you don't know everything. But
this is encouraging.
When you say holy city, where were you going with that thought? Is that just literally, this is the only other time I can think of this? Do you think that that's got some sort of this that shows that the whole story is being viewed from a later sort of chronological perspective, as in this is now being seen to symbolize something beyond itself?
Well, it could also fit with just Matthew's.
I know this might annoy you. I know this might annoy you, Andrew, but this might actually be an indication that there's some type, some chiasm going on in the book of Matthew.
I cannot believe that. If that turns out to be what the story has been all along.
Well, yeah, that would be really...
I'm not sure, but it's an interesting detail.
Especially because the temple detail there, the curtain of the temple being torn in two, and if the only other reference is being taken to the height, to the top of the temple, and that's where he quotes to him the scripture that says, you know, your foot won't be bruised, or I can't remember which psalm. It's a Davidic, it's a messianic psalm that Satan quotes at him in Matthew 4. What's the psalm?
Is it, I think Psalm 91, I think.
Yeah, Psalm 91.
I don't know. I do think it's interesting there. If the reference to the holy city is connected to a reference to the temple, well, we've got reference to the holy city in connection to the temple, and this happens right after his death. But there's the sign of life that's happening right there. You've got the people coming out of the tombs. That this is. It's clearly not actually a failure of that prophecy. And then actually isn't part. I mean, the whole dispute with the whole dispute in the temptation or in the trial in the wilderness is, if you really are the Son of God, and here you've got the confession of the guard, truly this was the Son of God. I don't know. Maybe there is a chiasm there of some sort of actually deeper connection between those passages, but I can't really make it stick besides the two or three connections we just mentioned.
I'm not sure at all. I'd be surprised if there is, but it's a curious
thing. Alistair, you floated that out there, and then I go out there with you, and then you hang me out to dry.
But it was such, what it's done
the chiasm reference
my
was just to annoy Andrew.
Yeah, exactly. I know it's vindicating my skepticism from root and branch. This is exactly what people do. They say, I think this might be a chiasm. They write it all down, and then they say, yes, but this doesn't mean anything. It doesn't illuminate anything. So,
a good chiasm does. But
I think it
might be interesting to ask, stepping back from the particular historical details here, what is the theological significance that we should give to this event?
So I got to read Calvin here. His phrase here is just amazing. So he says, this was also a striking miracle by which God declared that his son entered into the prison of death, not to continue to be shut up there, but to bring out all who were captive. For at the very time when the despicable weakness of the flesh was beheld in the person of Christ, the magnificent and divine energy of his death penetrated even to hell. This is the reason why he was about to be shut up in a sepulcher. Other sepulchers were opened by him. Yeah, and then he goes on to say, but it actually they didn't come out of the graves until like a couple days later. But still, he goes on this element where he actually thinks that when Christ died, the graves were immediately opened, and then when he rose, they followed him out a couple of days later. For he is definitively the first fruits of the dead, and it's a sign. So he sees it as a sign and kind of a promise, a little bit of an anticipation of, you know, 1 Corinthians 15:20. He's the first fruits of those who rise, and to show that his resurrection isn't a one-off. It's a resurrection that carries life in its train. It's a resurrection for us, not just for himself. So that's where Calvin goes with it. I'm tempted to follow there just because it fits so nicely with Paul and the rest of the New Testament.
The theological framework there works really well, but the problem is that the chronology of the event just doesn't seem to work in the sense that works. If obviously the first fruits theme, and I've just been flicking through Wright in his big resurrection book, and he makes the point that's like the one thing this text can't be doing is trying to validate a Pauline theology of, or even a Matthew's theology of resurrection, first fruits, and so on, for the very reason that it doesn't happen when it should happen. Unless we are to, because I think that's where the problem with the verse 54 comes in, and actually reflects the fact that, at least from Matthew's point of view, this story has been put there as something that the centurion and others noticed happening. Something happened on Good Friday, even if they didn't come out of the tombs until Sunday, which then raises the question, what were they doing in the tomb for 36 hours kind of thing? So I think the theological explanation works well if you ignore the historical dimension of it, but I'm not... Do you see what I mean?
Well, I'm a systematics guy, Andrew.
So why would I care what actually happened?
What we do, I'll let you guys sort out the details. No, but really, though, the question, though, is... But there is reason to question the chronology a little bit, possibly to see it as an aside.
So walk me through
temporal dislocation.
Walk me through how that happens. And so Jesus dies. The curtain of the temple is torn. Then there is an earthquake on Easter Sunday, but not then.
Midway through verse 51. If I'm following Calvin. The tombs open. The curtain of the temple's torn, earth shook, rocks were split, tombs also were opened, and then the bodies of the saints. Yeah, that's actually, I don't know. That's a question. That's a good question.
Calvin's just done with it fits theologically, but doesn't fit historically, or at least it doesn't, unless.
But the history's so weird at that point it's kind of a toss-up. That's the question.
I think the text reads as if the theological framework that Calvin's just sketched isn't. While it's still true, I don't think the text reads. I think as if that's happened. I think the text reads as if the bodies come out of the tomb.
Give me an alternative theology that makes better sense of the text. You think?
Well, no. I think the whole point is that the historical. That those few verses on their own do not present us with the same sequence of events that we find in elsewhere in the New Testament. Like, I don't think this is meant to be an example. That I suppose where I've got is the oddity of this story has just got to be left as an oddity. It's got to be that what actually happened was there was an earthquake and the tombs were opened and many people came to life, and they didn't actually go into the holy city and start telling everybody what had happened to them for whatever reason until Sunday. I can't see how else the text could be read, because verse 53 shows that they came into the city on Sunday, and verse 54 suggests that they were risen from the dead on the Friday. And I don't know how else
So you think, okay, so they came to life, they hang out, they wait. All right, Jesus is back. Let's go in and tell everybody.
It sounds just as weird to me as you just made it sound, but I can't see how else you can read the grammar and the flow of those events any differently, really. I mean, unless Alistair's going to come in with a sort of sweeping insight here, right?
Calvin or Wright.
It's something that could be told in retrospect, that when they saw all these things, events that began on the Good Friday, signs that began on Good Friday with the death of Christ, but weren't completed until later on, that the centurion confessed that truly this was the Son of God. Now, in the initial event, we have a confession in Mark's gospel, but here I think maybe it's including this centurion as a witness, not just to that initial event, but the broader events that are taking place, that he didn't just see that, he saw more than that.
Okay, so our two alternative chronologies are that Jesus... the resurrection of these people happens on the Friday, and then they don't come into the city on the Sunday, which is what I'm saying I think the text looks like it says, even though it's very bizarre. Or the alternative reading is actually the centurion's reflection is after the events of both Good Friday and Easter Sunday, and therefore we can get our theological reading a la Calvin, which fits better with our theology, and we have to make a couple of assumptions that the text is not explicit about the timing of the centurion's confession. Now,
two earthquakes otherwise.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, totally we do. I just think Matthew does too. That's all the, you know, I think he does.
Okay, just for fun, what is the problem with two earthquakes? Just throwing that out there. Earthquakes have aftershocks.
There's no problem. I just think it just there's no problem in theory, but I just think
we just don't like doubling.
That there was one great earthquake, particularly since what you do have here is an event that talks about coming out of the graves after his resurrection. So
right.
Presumably, I mean, the centurion sees the earthquake and the things that happened. The people guarding Jesus, they're not just guarding Jesus at the cross, they're guarding Jesus at the tomb as well. And those events start at the cross, but they happen later. And the appearance of the bodies of the saints in the holy city does not occur until later, after the resurrection. So to see that, you've already got anticipation of something that hasn't yet occurred within the immediate chronology.
So you could say then, so just to, in a sense, I could have a lot of Calvin there. Just the general fit theology, but whereas he sees this, he sees the tombs opening immediately, and then them coming out a couple days later after the resurrection. You know, the divine energy. You know, it happens after. It happens at the resurrection. It's a single earthquake, etc. And you kind of delay the sign of God's divine energy entering even to the depths of hell itself. That's not revealed until a couple of days later, in that sense. It's what we're kind of landing at, or is what we're suggesting. So they come out at the same time as Christ. Go for it.
I think that's got to be your. They clearly come out of the tombs on Sunday. I think that then the question of whether there's an earthquake and go into the city, that is, whether there's whether there are two earthquakes or one, and whether that's split almost. I mean, in some ways, what I find interesting about all this, details aside, is the way in which this mirrors exactly what you ask theologically about. You know, what is it that saves? You know, you're often trying to do that, aren't you? Trying to bundle together Friday and Sunday and saying, it's not the death without the resurrection without the crucifixion don't work. It's the fact that both of them happen together. And then, of course, people ask the question, well, what about Saturday? Or, you know, what if I died on that day? Or, you know, those sorts of questions. Is the guy who dies next to Jesus and professes faith, what about him? And you say, well, of course, you can do that, but you don't want to build your theology out of that. And in some ways, this is a lovely paradigm for looking at that question, saying there is the displacement is itself part of the oddity of it. It's saying for this 36-hour period, things are out of shape. There is an overlap of worlds. There is something inexplicable that's taken place, half of which has been accomplished and half of which hasn't. I almost wonder if that's part of the way that we're supposed to take this passage. I also, while I have the microphone, just think it's hilarious that the systematician immediately goes to, this is what the theology would be, but that's not what the text says. The biblical theology goes, well, this is what the text says, even though I don't understand the theology. And Alistair is caught completely with a wedgie in between, trying to make sure he keeps his foot in both camps and doesn't know what to do with it. And this, to me, is just a classic biblical versus systematics discussion 101.
Well, here's the thing. At that point, it's just me being like, well, okay, this text is weird and ambiguous. I'm just gonna take the whole scope of scripture and do my best to make sense out of it. Right?
Very wise.
So that's kind of my instinctive move. And in the context of the podcast, I'm assuming y'all are gonna set me straight. But that actually makes sense though, because what you're saying, and I do think that whole sweep, and you've got the curtain of the temple torn in two, but there's a delay of a couple of days before we understand the significance of what has been accomplished actually on Friday. Much has been accomplished, but it's not completed, it's not delivered, it's not made public or fully realized until Sunday when it walks forward from the tomb, when Jesus walks out of the tomb, he's already conquered. He's already conquered the essential victory. He's already brought together God-man. He's already dealt with sin, and he's already begun to plunder hell itself. Which, interestingly enough, this element of bringing them out of the grave. There is just that victory, that very strong divine power at work testimony there. That there's oftentimes, I feel like sometimes in maybe an evangelical account, sometimes we emphasize the atonement in terms of there's a moral transaction that has taken place. There's an accounting. There's a vindication. There's a justification. There's, which is all true. Defend it to the last bit. But there's also just this sheer divine power at work of just bringing people up from the dead that needs to be stared at for a while in all of its weirdness and all of its holiness. This is just God being utterly beyond our normal accounting of the way the world works, you know. So beyond just the moral terms, it's just sheer power, the divine energy of his death, going down to hell and bringing people back up. So that's one of the things that strikes me there. Al?
Also worth noticing that the testimony is not just from the centurion. It's also from the others, those with him who are guarding Jesus. So it's the bro, and if you look in Matthew, more than any of the other Gospels, it places a lot of emphasis upon the centurion and the guards. So in the chapters, in the end of that chapter and in the chapter that follows, there are little incidents that concern just talking about the guards and the soldiers set up to prevent the disciples from stealing the body away. And then later, the bribing of the soldiers after they've seen and then all the guards seeing the descent of the angel of the Lord. And so the amount of attention given to them is quite considerable. It's far more than we would expect, which suggests that there's a significance here. And also that can help us to explain that it's not just the bringing together of those events is also something that's probably working out by including the centurion's testimony and then the testimony of the others who are guarding, including those who are at the tomb and those who are hearing the testimony of those who are at the tomb.
Can I throw in one more? I have one more theological possible implication to draw from this, more with the sort of, preaching and application perspective. Do you think this is weird? Okay, so the shaking and splitting of the earth, the splitting of the tombs or the opening of the tombs and the splitting of the temple curtain, the three things that open out and effectively break, two of those three are to varying degrees of explicitly about death. And I wonder if the third is as well. So you have the tombs being open, obviously about death. You have the earth shaking and the rocks being split. Effectively, within the cosmology, the idea of, you have heaven, you have the earth, and then that below the earth. I think that a parallel there, the land below the earth is the land of the dead, and the idea of that being broken open. I wonder, though, is there a sense in which that's also true, that the curtain, is there a sort of the ministry of reconciliation is far greater than the ministry that brings death, the ministry written on tablets of stone, the ministry that kills, a sort of 2 Corinthians 3, 4 thing going on in the tearing of the temple curtain? Am I completely overcooking that to see that in there as well and saying this is three, death, thou shalt die kind of moments in the same little story being bundled together? Is that just too clever or too stupid?
Well, what's interesting is I scanned down in Calvin's commentary and he picks up the phrase and went into the holy city. Hey, you know what? He's still good. And he notices the oddness of that designation. And he says, when Matthew bestows on Jerusalem the honorable designation of the holy city, he's not, applauding the character of its inhabitants, but rather that it had been chosen by God. Its holiness was founded on God's adoption, couldn't be effaced by any corruptions of men till its rejection was openly declared. Or, to express more briefly, on the part of man it was profane, and on the part of God it was holy, till the destruction or pollution of the temple, which happened not long after the crucifixion of Christ. So he's making the link that you're talking about there. The tearing of the temple is kind of like it's a foretaste of the destruction that's going to come, and the end of the sacrificial system that is, in a sense, dead now, in the death of Christ, which has brought it to an end. And so that seems to be that, I don't know, that 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 would that's plausible to me theologically and textually, especially if you start connecting it out, connecting it earlier to predictions of, you know, the downfall of the Holy City, or the downfall of Jerusalem at the hands of the Romans and so forth, and then also just forward theologically and things like Hebrews and so forth. So that could be the conjunction between that designation of the Holy City and the temple being torn, the curtain of the temple being torn could be significant there. So, yeah.
The veil of the temple is also the thing that stands, prevents people from having access to God's immediate presence.
Right.
And the grave is a further veil, that there's not the worship of God in Sheol in the same way. People are cut off, and there's a further veil, as it were, between them and God's presence. And this is the breaking through of both of those veils. And also, it's a movement from the world where you have the dead going to Sheol to a world where the dead go to God's presence. And so the rising of the saints is something that actually happens at that point in history. There's a change in the afterlife, as it were. There's a change in a movement from people dying, going to Sheol, to Abraham's bosom, to going to God's presence in heaven.
And that brings up the weird, just if we got like one more minute, like Calvin asked the question, now what happened to the, like, you might wonder what happened to these folks? like how did they just kind of ghost afterwards or die again? Or, I mean, they were dead. They're not going to die again. Like, did they? Yeah. So that's, man, there's probably no time to.
There probably isn't. I'm definitely going that they did die again. I think they're like Lazarus in that sense. That doesn't worry me so much, actually. But
Well, you do have other events like that in those thrown into the grave of Elijah, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or is it Elijah?
Yeah. Elijah, yeah. I think it's Elisha in 2 Kings 12, somewhere like that. But yeah. And so it's not unprecedented. And you have some other mysterious disappearances, don't you? Like, you know, Enoch or Elijah himself or whatever. But yeah, I think they must have died again in the same way as Lazarus or the widow of Nain's son would have. But you're right. It is very bizarre.
You wonder if they like just kind of like quickly came through and then just walked away and then went into the presence of God somehow, somewhere.
Well, I think one thing we see within Revelation is the souls beneath the altar who wish to be raised up. So there is this, the difference between Sheol and ascending into heaven, that Jesus empties out, as it were, the bosom of Abraham, that he empties out where everyone goes to Sheol, and the righteous and the wicked alike. But there is judgment upon the wicked and the righteous rest with their fathers. There's a change that occurs after the resurrection of Christ. And after, particularly, that's associated with the temple veil being torn, that now people can ascend into God's presence, that death is no longer the same thing for someone who dies after Christ's resurrection. It's not the same thing as it would have been for someone dying prior. I think that is the theological background of what's taking place here.
Guys, with that, it sounds like such a... We could probably keep going. I know we could, but we can't. So we must not. But with that, guys, this is a great discussion. Andrew, thanks for joining us again as our regular guest. Once again, having you on. If you are a listener, we hope that you benefited from this conversation, even half as much as I think we all did. This was a lot of fun, just seeing what happens when you jump into a scripture you're not sure about, and then seeing what can come out of it. But until the next time. Thanks for listening.